ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. One of Australia's most well-known live export shipping companies, as of today, has no more ships.
Well, it means we have no ships left, so it's the final ship. So we're a shipping company without ship.
Yep, Wellard has officially sold its last vessel, the MV Ocean Drover. So what next for this ASX-listed company? You'll find out soon. Also this afternoon, this is not good. Fire ants are on the march. They've just been found at five different mine sites in Queensland.
My big concern is that we have a fire ant program that's operating on a finite budget, and some of these outbreaks are going to be quite expensive and could take resources away from the eradication work in the main fire ant stronghold in southeast Queensland.
And with territory mangoes now allowed into WA, how are WA growers feeling about all of this? You'll find out this afternoon on the Country Hour. A busy show. Let's get amongst it. We're broadcasting right across the territory on the ABC, and g'day there if you've tuned in via the podcast. It's been a busy year for Anthony and Danielle Haig, who grow fodder crops near Tea Tree using centre pivot irrigation. The demand for their hay has been absolutely huge this year, with plenty of orders coming in from farmers struggling with drought in southern parts of this nation. Danielle says they've just installed some brand new pivots and have planted barley for the first time.
So we've just installed three new centre pivots to our property and just planted three new crops under them. So under each one, we've done a combination. They called it the Anthony combination of lucerne, barley and oats. So they're under... Each pivot is approximately 14 hectares.
This is your first time planting barley out there at Athel Outback Hideaway. Can you tell us a little bit about why you've decided to plant barley?
So it's always been a trial and error for us growing hay, growing fodder in the middle of the territory in the desert. So we never know what was going to work or if it was going to work. So we are trialing the barley. This is the first time for it. Not sure how it's going to go, but we'll soon find out in the next couple of months.
Any reason in particular barley was the next one you wanted to try? Were there any other crops being considered?
We were considering vetch that we have tried before on a smaller paddock, but it just the roads kind of broke through and took over it, so it wasn't really successful. So yeah, this is just something that was recommended to us from the agronomist, and then we can only try really.
So you've moved in to barley, you've planted your first crop of it. What is the market for barley right now? Where do you think you'll be looking at to move it onto once it's been cut?
We definitely aim to keep it in the territory. We always wanted to, one of the reasons why we started our business was to stay local. So we have had a good response from our current clients and hopefully get some new ones in the local area.
There's obviously been a lot of demand for fodder and hay down south. Do you expect some of it will also go down there as well?
I'm not entirely sure whether it will or not at this stage. Obviously, there is a huge shortage of fodder across the SA at the moment, and we would love to help out as much as we can. But, we want to stick to supplying the locals before we take it out of state.
You did mention just then that there has been huge demand coming from down south. We chatted earlier, and it sounds like they've been buying it quicker than you can grow it for them.
That is true. Yeah, we've had heaps of calls from down south, and unfortunately fortunately for us, it's all sold, but unfortunately for those down south, we haven't been able to keep up with the demand. So hoping we might be able to help them out in the future. We're not sure how everything's going to go. As I said, it's been a major trial and error growing hay in the middle of the desert.
Does that demand from down south give you a bit of hope maybe to expand your own operations?
Well, at the moment, we're just sticking to what we can with our water license. Like, obviously, we need to trial these three first before we know whether we're hitting our limits. And then, yeah, hopefully we might be able to put in some more to be able to cater for that growing demand of fodder.
Earlier on, you mentioned that you've chosen barley based on some advice you got from an agronomist. Do you have any idea yet of what you might expect for tons per hectare?
No idea, not at all yet. Yeah, that will be something when we get our first cut, we'll kind of know what to expect.
When do you hope or expect that you might be able to start cutting this most recent crops that you've planted?
Depending on the weather, we are hoping for about 8 weeks' time. So it's already been a couple of weeks since it's been planted, and it has started, it has popped up. So, yeah, fingers crossed it all goes ahead.
Have you had any sales yet already before it's been harvested?
Yeah, so we do go to our clients that have been with us from the beginning and who have supported us from the beginning. So we do go to them first and we say, hey, what's your year looking like next year? How much do you think you'll need? So we always make sure that we have enough for them. And then, yeah, we put the offer out there to others, which, yes, we have already had, yeah, few road train loads already sold out there. So, yeah, it's definitely, I do see it going to be a huge success, I feel. Yeah, it just depends what happens when, how much we get off each pivot when we do cut it, the quality of it, you know, did we give it enough water, everything else. We'll have to wait and see once it's cut and baled and see if what we've got, really.
That's Danielle Haig from Athel Outback Hideaway near Tea Tree speaking to Charles Geary about the farm's new centre pivots and growing new crops and just the rising demand for fresh hay out of central Australia. And as mentioned, Danielle is planting barley for the first time. Now, our text number at the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. Personally, I can't remember a story of someone growing barley in the Northern Territory. I can't remember an example of this, but perhaps someone listening this afternoon can remember someone tinkering with barley before. I'd be keen to get a history lesson if you know of someone who's tried barley in the Territory before. So our text number is 0487 99 1057. Barley being grown near Tea Tree. Have we seen this before? Would love to hear from you this afternoon.
G'day, I'm Walter Batham, underground truck driver here at Tanami Newmont. You're listening to the Country Hour.
And it's barley to be fed to livestock. I mean, I guess the next step for Danielle and the team there is to start growing some hops. They've got the water. Tea Tree beer. That's the dream. That text number for the Country Hour is 0487 99 1057. Now, how about this? Live export shipping company Wellard, as of today, doesn't own any ships. The company has informed the ASX that it has completed the sale of its last remaining livestock vessel, the MV Ocean Drover. So that boat's been bought by Meteors Shipping SA for about $50 million. So that's about 77.5 Aussie dollars. It's been sold or done. So what next for a shipping company that doesn't have any ships? Well, Wellard's executive director, John Klepek, he's previously told the Country Hour that once the Ocean Drover was sold, the company's only remaining potential income was the possibility of getting some compensation from the live export ban's class action.
Well, it means we have no ships left, so it's the final ship. So we're a shipping company without ships. So effectively, it means we have to look at what we do with the remaining the shell of the company. We have cash on hand, which obviously will be surplus, which we will return to shareholders as well. The major asset we have is the Brett class action, or we wouldn't call it an asset, it's a claim which we believe we will get some proceeds from that in a period of time. It's hard to put an exact timeline on it, but the Wellard shareholders will be beneficiaries of whatever claim eventually comes through from that. Like I said, we're positive that there will be something. How much and when, we don't know. So that is something that we need to have a mechanism to get that back to the shareholders once it eventually comes. So,
but how much, John? What would you be looking at realistically from that settlement?
It's too difficult to put a number on. We obviously have a claim on there which is confidential, and I can't comment on that because it's part of a legal process. We simply can't put a number on it. It's not a huge amount, but it's not an insignificant amount either.
That this class action is enough to actually keep Wellard going, to see what you can secure, what compensation you can secure from this action.
Oh, yeah, we wouldn't be liquidating the company because there is an amount there that has to be returned to the shareholder somehow. There's multiple mechanisms, but the entity that is entitled to that proceeds of that claim needs to stay alive to get the proceeds of the claim, and the shareholders are the ones who will be the beneficiaries of that. But we wouldn't be keeping the whole structure. It would be, a slimline structure. That's one possibility. That's where we would delist the company, and it'll just be a legal entity kept alive for the proceeds of the action.
You're right, correct. So that's the only reason that you would keep the company going?
That's at the moment. That's the only potential income producing activity that we have. But in terms of, the company itself, the ships are gone. What's left is the Brett class action. And if it wasn't for that, one of the options is to, liquidate the company. We haven't made that decision yet. We've got some time between now and potentially that. We put a line in the sand as of the AGM of this year, which is, November this year. So by that time, we're not going to keep this thing going around forever. There's rules against that.
That is John Klepek from Wellard speaking to Belinda Varaschetti a few months back. So the news today is that the sale of the MV Ocean Drover has been settled, and it remains the case that Wellard is essentially staying afloat purely now to perhaps get compensation from the Brett class action, which centres around the live export ban in 2011 and the successful class action in 2020. As you're potentially aware of, that class action is still going. Only the Brett family have received any form of compensation, and it's all due back in court in March of next year. Wellard has been slowly flogging off its fleet. It sold the Ocean Swagman in 2019. For $22 million. The next year sold the Ocean Shearer for $53 million, and then last year sold the Ocean Ute for $12 million, and now has sold the MV Ocean Drover for $50 million. So all up, if I've got my calculator right here, that's about $137 million worth of ships. Comes in at over 210 Aussie dollars, millions. So the fleet is gone. And Wellard now waits.
I'm Lockie Bear. I'm from Monadnock Station in the Northern Territory. And you're listening to the ABC Country Hour.
Has anyone tried growing barley in the Northern Territory before? Let me know, 0487991057. It's just gone into the ground around Tea Tree. Has it been done before? Let me know, 0487991057. Now, up next on the Country Hour, it's not a good story. I'll be telling you about the latest outbreak of fire ants. Right after a bit of Marty Robbins.
Big Iron Ore is here.
It is 12 to 1 and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Fire ants are continuing to spread through Queensland, with authorities confirming today that they've found some new nests at 5 different mine sites in Queensland's Bowen Basin. Investigations suggest they spread from southeast Queensland in a pallet load of bricks. Tom Roberts is the operations director at the National Fire Ant Eradication Program. He explained what's happened to Liam O'Connell.
All I can say is that they've been found at several additional mine sites in the Central Highlands and the Isaac Council regions.
Have the operators and the workers at the mine sites been notified?
They have, and we're just working with them at this point in regards to, I suppose, the next steps on our response and making sure that all, I suppose, known risks are identified and treated.
Have all the nests that you've found now been eradicated using that direct nest injection?
Yeah, that's correct. And we've also applied a level of broad-scale bait around those nests as well.
Are you conducting further odour dog detections in the next couple of days to determine if it's spread further?
We won't be on any of the other sites. So we've actually visited several other mine sites that receive bricks from where we suspected they came from southeast Queensland, and they proved negative. So at this point, we've only identified in total four additional to the Broadmeadow site.
So five nests in total?
Five sites in total.
Okay. Do we know roughly how many nests were discovered and destroyed?
Not at this point. There was. It's only been a handful.
I mean, what kind of mitigation efforts will you be undertaking to ensure that there's no risk of any potential human-assisted spread in the coming days?
Obviously, we've been on and done the surveillance and eradicated all nests that we've been able to identify. We've had specific teams up there doing site surveillance and compliance teams up there identifying any known risks and making sure that they're all addressed and eliminated.
So what do the next few days look like for you?
It will just be getting all the information from each of these sites to work out, I suppose, the next phase of the response and ensuring that, the risk is mitigated as soon as possible.
How concerned should the broader community be, given that this is quite a big escalation?
At this point, we believe, from the number of nests that we've been able to identify, it's relatively low, and we believe we've got them relatively early. So surrounding properties, all I can do is strongly encourage people to be aware and look for them. We will be providing as much information for the public in the coming weeks of just what to look for, where to report them, and just to be vigilant and on the lookout.
That's Tom Roberts from the National Fire Ant Eradication Program. The Invasive Species Council reckons mining companies should be stepping in to cover the cost of fire ant outbreaks linked to their operations. Advocacy manager Rhys Pianta says taxpayers shouldn't have to foot the bill for what he calls corporate carelessness.
The fire ant zone, the infestation area, is under biosecurity orders that relate to carrier materials coming in and out of that zone. And in this case, we think that it was a contractor to BHP moving these materials around. But we do need responsibility exercised at every part of the chain. You know, we've seen, for example, in New South Wales, they've put requirements on people who are receiving shipments from southeast Queensland into New South Wales to check and preventatively treat those things when they reach a certain risk threshold. We aren't part of the investigation, so we don't know what specific areas there might have been gaps in the management of these shipments. But what we do know is that there's five sites that have fire and infestation in central Queensland. There needs to be a swift response to that. There needs to be ongoing monitoring. That's quite resource intensive from a fire and eradication program that is already having its resources stretched. So anything that BHP can do to support that, I think will be welcomed and applauded by the community at large.
What part of their actions so far do you think were the careless actions that might have led to this?
Yeah, well, let's put it this way. What we want is for everyone in Australia who's receiving anything from southeast Queensland, from the fire and infestation area, to exercise extreme caution, to check what they're getting, to ask questions about, if it's been inspected before it's been sent, if it's been preventatively treated to prevent fire ants from surviving that trip, and on the receiving end, to exercise due diligence in checking the shipments that they're getting as soon as possible. We know that These shipments were sitting in place for, months in some cases before some of these checks occurred. We need a much higher level of diligence if we're going to prevent fire ants spreading to other parts of Australia. And if there's regulatory gaps there, that's where we need our governments to be stepping in. Now, in this case, again, applaud BHP for finding and reporting these nests, but we do need to step up our game across the country. You know, we're calling the fire ants a national emergency. It's got a huge government response. The impact to our nation will be of a scale of a major disaster, like a flood, like a fire, like a cyclone. You know, it's time for us to get that message out there. We all need to be taking this much more seriously.
Do you think there have been rules broken that might lead to some sort of penalisations?
There could potentially be penalties levied under the Biosecurity Act for breaching the biosecurity orders in the movement, the shipment of materials, the carrying of restricted biosecurity matter, which fire ants are. We've seen penalties being issued in the past to some businesses, particularly things like in the turf and hay movement industries. And we've seen much higher levels of compliance in those industries over the last 12 months, much lower instances of fire ants being found in shipping materials from those industries. So it is possible the level of those fines would vary based on the results of the investigation. But in some cases, I've seen them running into the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, that's not of a scale that matches the costs in most cases of responding to and managing these fire ant outbreak events. I think the fundamental message, the urgent message we need to get out to people is stay vigilant when you're collecting things from Southeast Queensland. Nobody wants to inadvertently spread fire ants, but it is also a legal responsibility to not spread fire ants. It's just the right thing to do for the country as well. What we do need is a much higher level of vigilance around shipments coming out of fire ant infestation zones.
BHP reported it to the fire ant program straight away. Do you think chastising the mining companies, does that risk that maybe at one of these other mine sites or the next detection site, if it's another organisation, them sort of just ignoring seeing it and not reporting it because they're worried that if they mention it, then they'll be called on to pay for getting rid of them?
Well, I'm confident that BHP, in many instances, seek to be a model corporate citizen. So, for them, getting on the front foot and finding these things as soon as possible has a business incentive for them. You know, there's obviously their social license of being able to ensure they're protecting the community from biosecurity risks like fire ants. But then fire ants can also have an impact to their operations in terms of lost utility of land, workplace health and safety, putting their people at risk on their sites. So there's some real incentives for businesses to find fire ants as early as possible and report them.
That is Rhys Pianta from the Invasive Species Council speaking to Liam McNally. Not good. New nests found at five different mine sites in Queensland's Bowen Basin. Fire ants continue to spread. Not good at all. Just quickly to some resources news. The company that's hoping to start up a major rare earths mine and processing facility in Central Australia, it says it's received firm commitments to raise $80 million. Arafura Rare Earths Limited says it's also now looking to raise an extra $5 million via a share purchase plan. So essentially, it's offering to sell shares at 19 cents each, and that's why the company's share price has fallen today, down 13% to that 19 cent mark. It's a big project. It's a big project there in the centre, and it needs a lot of capital. You might remember the project received a NAIF loan last year to the tune of $200 million. The NAIF board's actually meeting in Alice Springs this week. Chairwoman Tracy Hayes says the NAIF has a really important role to play in getting big projects up and going in the north, like Arafura's rare earths project.
NAIF has committed $200 million to the Arafura project. It's this is a significant rare earth project, and it's well understood, I think, around the nation that it's a highly sought after resource, and they're big, complex, lumpy deals. Our team's really committed in contributing to that. What that will mean to the Alice Springs community is, I guess, difficult to quantify at this point in time, but it will be a game changer in terms of the opportunities it will create for the rural and regional areas surrounding the town.
That's Tracy Hayes, former boss of the NT Cattlemen's Association and currently the chair of the NAIF, the North Australia Infrastructure Facility, which is meeting in the Alice this week.
G'day, Rob Hall here from Airway Logistics at the Darwin Export Hub. We support industry here to export rock melons, watermelons, pumpkins and mango to the world straight out of Darwin. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. If you've just tuned in, you've missed a lot, including our catch-up with Danielle Haig from Athel Outback Hideaway. So this farm is near Tea Tree, and Danielle was telling us today that they've installed a few new centre pivots, and for the first time, they're having a crack at growing barley.
We are trialling the barley. This is the first time for it. Not sure how it's going to go, but we'll soon find out in the next couple of months.
And I put the question to you, has anyone tried growing barley before in the Northern Territory? I personally can't remember any barley stories in the NT. And, gee, I love that Country Hour audience. You're onto it. I've got a message here from Mark who says, "G'day, Matt. Sam Miles and the late Frank McAllister had a crop development program at Tea Tree in the late 60s, early 70s, screening many crops, including barley. Mark says a patch was excised from the pastoral lease, balls were sunk, crops were trialled. Subsequently, Ian Dahlenberg took up the lease on the department's research block and established the Tea Tree Farm and Vineyard. Much has been trialled in the NT and much of it is documented," says Mark this afternoon. Really appreciate that, mate. 0487991057. When you say vineyards, do you mean table grapes? Or have we had a crack at wine production? I remember there was, I think it was the community radio station in Alice Springs a few years ago for a certain anniversary, grew some wine grapes. I can't remember how it went. They got as far as plonking it in bottles. Stuart Brash strikes me as a fellow who might have had a swig on that. Might have to call him. But Mark, yeah, when you say vineyards, you're talking just table grapes or the wine varieties there at Tea Tree. I'm intrigued now. We've still got plenty to come between now and 1:30. Including a trip to the Australian Society for Fish Biology Conference, which has been held in Darwin this week. All kinds of fishy business going on there, which you'll learn about in a moment. But first, let's go to the Weather Bureau. Sally Cutter's there this afternoon. How are you, Sally?
Oh, not too bad, thanks.
Still a lot of fire out in the landscape of the Northern Territory. What are conditions like?
Well, it's still certainly very dry out there. Maybe not quite as dry as yesterday, but it's still pretty dry. The winds are easing off just slightly, so that's good, just simply because wind is one of the things that goes into the calculation. So the lower the wind, the lower the fire dangers. And then the temperatures are still some moderate temperatures. They are going to warm up in the end of the week as we lose the southeasterly winds into the top end and go more easterly, and then down south we've got them turning more northerly, so it's going to be warming up down through central Australia as well as the series of troughs approach and the more major one approaches over the weekend and into Monday.
Yeah, tell us about the next big change that's set to come through.
Yeah, this one looks like it's going to be quite windy. We've got So we've got little troughs going through. This is a more major one. There's really good winds through depth of the atmosphere ahead of it. So once you get the heating going, it's going to just bring down stronger winds. So on Monday, we could see possibly even a little bit of strong winds down through the Leicester and maybe into the southern Simpson, but mainly through Leicester. But right across that southern part, it's going to be mainly wind. Not much rain, if any, going to get into the NT. So it's just going to be that dry, hot winds. And then we got the change comes through, or moves through some during Monday and Tuesday. And exactly the timing of it will depend on how much the temperatures drop on any given day. But we're looking at sizable drops across the southern parts of the NT in the first half of the week. And then that surge moves northwards, but there's a little bit of conflicting information how quickly it gets into sort of the Gregory and the Northern Barkly. But it does look like it is going to work its way north. Maybe not quite in the top end. That's a little bit too far out at this stage, but it's just something that people should probably keep an eye on.
Okay. Has it got the potential to really fan some of these fires that we see?
Most of the wind is really going to be down in the southern parts of the Gregory and the Leicester. As it moves northwards, it's going to probably be more your morning bursts as it gets up into the Barkly. Into the top end, it just depends exactly how strong the high is and how strong the trough, or how mobile that trough is that's pushing north. Some of the models are just a little bit slower in bringing it northwards, which means the surge doesn't quite get into the top end. But there is going to be that little bit of respite with the winds and increased humidity before that arrives. So hopefully that's going to help get into those fires out, or at least allow them to be got on top of.
Right.
But then we might also see some fogs developing, and including sea fogs in the Gulf over the weekend.
I'm just looking at the 7-day forecast for Berry Springs. It's expecting a top of 37 come the weekend.
Yeah.
That's starting to get pretty darn warm. That's mango warm, that is.
Yeah, it's the winds are easing off and so we're getting that humidity, and so we're not cooling down overnight as much, and the sun's getting, but we still haven't really got that big cloud cover either, so the sun is feeling the full effect and it's getting closer as it works its way southwards.
Yeah, okay. Anything else we should be aware of this afternoon?
No, just to look out for those winds on the coastal waters. It's still a little bit windy out there. We have had that strong wind warning current early this morning, and it's been cancelled now, but the winds are still up across the water. So that's probably, if you're heading out on the water, that's the Roper Group side. And then just be aware that we do still have those really dry conditions, which are not favourable for humans interacting with fire. The fires, it's good to keep the fires going, I suppose is what I'm trying to say, so just be careful.
Which is not good.
No. This is the one of those, well, I said it's not good for humans with fire.
Thanks so much, Sally. Have a lovely afternoon.
Will do, thanks.
Sally Cutter there at the Weather Bureau, and just looking at the NAFI website this afternoon, still a lot of active fire on Jindere Station to the southwest of Pine Creek. And looks like there's a lot of fire along the Stuart Highway, sort of near the old Hayes Creek petrol station there, the roadhouse. There's a lot of fire sort of between Hayes Creek and Emerald Springs, if you can picture that on the map. There's still fire on Mambaloo Station, but that threat seems to be dying down. There's not much cow food left on Mambaloo, it would seem. There's fires to the south of Timber Creek as we go to Ware this afternoon. And it looks like the team at Newry Station have done a very good job at getting on top of a fire that had been burning through a fair bit of country there as well. A lot of smoke around the top end at the moment. Stay up to date via that NAFI website.
On Landline this week, the school kids learning and loving agriculture.
The cattle club's definitely the hook, and it gets them interested in agriculture.
Landline, Sunday, 12:30 on ABC TV and on iView.
And the Marker Report, Pip. How good is the Marker Report? It is 13 past one and you are tuned into the Country Hour. Hundreds and hundreds of fish scientists are in Darwin this week for the Australian Society for Fish Biology Conference. They're in town talking all sorts of things. Mud crabs, swordfish, jewfish, prawns,
taking a look at some of the latest technology. It's all happening. Fiona Broom went along to the conference and caught up with Chair Dr. Joe Randall.
So it's an annual conference that occurs in different locations in Australia every year. It attracts about 300 delegates, and that's fisheries managers, fisheries researchers, marine and aquaculture. We've got Connecting Waters, Indigenous Engagement and Working on Country sessions. We've got Northern Australian Fisheries Research. There's a whole range, really.
Are scientific communities here, are they focused on risks to aquatic species, or are they talking more about successes?
Well, there's a big focus on sustainable fisheries, but there's actually, you know, it's got a very positive bent to conference. There's a lot of hope and a lot of encouragement in the research that's going on.
Anything that you've heard about this week that's particularly encouraging to you?
I've just really enjoyed, there's been some group discussions, panel discussions and sessions with working with traditional owners on country, and there's been a lot of respect and a lot of attendance in these sessions.
How much focus has there been on the things that we can eat that live in our aquatic spaces?
There's been a lot of work, a lot of talks on managing future change and climate change risks and changing environment in fishery species.
How much of a challenge does climate change pose to commercial fisheries?
I guess more broadly, rather than in terms of risk, it's a changing fishery. So you've got changing distributions and changing abundances. And I guess the key takeaway from a lot of the talks has been planning for these changes in advance, so mitigating and having strategies for management.
What are some of those management strategies, particularly for Northern Territory fisheries?
I think in terms of the changing distributions and abundances, we really need to plan ahead, maybe changing harvest strategies and tax to kind of account for this, moving to different fishery species as things change.
In light of that, is there much focus on aquaculture here?
Yes, there's. We've got quite a few members of the Darwin Aquaculture Centre here presenting research, and there's been quite a few talks on aquaculture and emerging aquaculture species.
You yourself are a fish scientist, Joe. You focus on black jewfish. How are stocks looking in the Northern Territory?
Well, black jewfish is a kind of at risk of overfishing in general across its worldwide distribution, just because it aggregates so much. Our last stock assessment here put them in really good shape. That was several years ago now. They are currently managed since 2023 under an aggregation tack for the separate aggregation areas, so they're quite well managed.
We've heard in the past that the market for black jewfish swim bladders has put some pressure on the fisheries. Is that still an ongoing concern?
Yeah, they have a really valuable swim bladder, and it's really quite large, so it makes the fishery a really high-value fishery. But because we have the quota management, catches are capped.
Is there a black market in that space?
I think it's safe to assume there. You would have to say there is some component of black market fishing. We do have a compliance unit that's newly established in the Northern Territory, so that's always something that they're going to be looking at.
So coming away from this conference this week, there's still another day or two to go. What's sort of the key message for you that's come out of all of this fish science that's been spoken about?
I guess it goes back to the conference theme, which is really connecting waters. So it's people, policy and science all together for stronger fish futures. And basically sums up what we're all about, is to get everybody working together and working towards the benefit of all fisheries.
Are fish futures looking strong?
I think so.
That is Dr. Jo Randall from NT Fisheries, and she's one of the chairs of this year's Australian Society for Fish Biology Conference. That is on in Darwin this week, right across the territory. On the ABC, you're tuned into the Country Hour. I think I started to get a bit thirsty a moment ago, just thinking, dreaming about this idea of maybe growing wine grapes in the Northern Territory. But I've been put back in my place. Mark says, no, Matt, table grapes. Table grapes were Darlingbergs, where they were also growing melons and asparagus back in the day. And this is where Marciano is now and where the hay production is. It's at the old table grape area that was up and running back in the 90s. Thank you for that, Mark. And another message here that says, table grapes and wine grapes were at Dennis Hornsby's, the Chateau Hornsby south of the Gap, earliest red vintage in Australia, and did get the heart rate up and going. Alex Nelson may have a bit more info about it. So was that way back, or was that the one I was thinking of the other day about? It was a community radio station there in the Alice. Is that the one? I've got producer Fiona nodding her head at me there. And, yeah, apparently it was. It was a red wine, and it had a fair bit of kick in it. I'll try and dig up some more information about that. It is 19 past one. One of our big stories last week was the announcement that a protocol's been signed that will allow Northern Territory mangoes to cross the border and get into WA. Now, how are growers in WA feeling about all of this? You'll hear from them next. In the West, Tommy Curtin, who's actually putting on a big concert this Friday at his Catherine Outback Experience. Give Tom and Annabelle a call if you're keen to head along to that one. Now, big mango news this month is that the Northern Territory and WA governments have agreed on a fruit fly management protocol that will allow territory mangoes to cross the border and get into WA markets. Growers in the territory, like Marie Piccone, are very happy with the outcome.
Well, I'm just so relieved that we're going to have access to the West Australia. And I think there's a lot of mango lovers in West Australia. They're probably quite relieved as well, because a lot of fruit does come from the territory and from the east coast of Australia to service the demand in West Australia. And it's an important market to us.
But what do mango growers in Western Australia think of this decision? Chris Robinson's been growing mangoes for more than 30 years in the Kimberley's Ord Irrigation Scheme. He says as long as all the biosecurity rules are followed, the new protocol makes sense.
We need to have Northern Territory fruit come into the Perth market, because we do not produce enough fruit in Kununurra, in the Ord Irrigation Area, to supply the Perth market. My hope would be that any fruit that does come into the Perth market is good quality fruit, because in previous years we've had a lot of relatively low and poor quality fruit finding its way into the Perth market, which is not good for our marketing.
So you think this new ICA 69 protocol is a good thing for WA growers?
No, not necessarily. But it is a way that the territory growers can get access into the Perth market. But they've had access into the Perth market through other protocols for a number of years now. So I don't think it's going to change an awful lot. And like I said, we need territory fruit in the Perth market to supply the Perth market, because we do not produce enough fruit in Kununurra to do that. And while I would like to have the Perth market to ourselves entirely, I don't think that's practical. I think we need the territory fruit in the Perth market. So, like I said, my hope is that when they send fruit in, they send in good quality fruit. We do not want to get Queensland fruit fly into Western Australia. Mm-hmm. And that's why Western Australia has these strict quarantine laws, because people like myself and the rest of the industry are trying to make sure that we don't end up with these pests and diseases.
So what kind of prices are you getting for your mangoes these days, and has that price changed much over the years?
Prices have not significantly changed in the last 30 years. They've fluctuated up and down, but they have not significantly increased in the last 30 years, whereas our costs have quadrupled in that time. The profit margin on mangoes nowadays, depending on what the year is. Now, if you've got a high price year, then it's not too bad. But if you, most years, your profits on costs are very narrow. They're very small.
So you've been doing this for 35 odd years. Have there been times where you seriously thought about walking away?
Not seriously. There have been times when we haven't made any money. We just went through a period of about 10 years where we got negative returns for about 10 years in a straight, 10 years straight, and that made it very difficult for us. You invest a lot of money and then you pick and pack and send your mangoes away and you don't make anything out of them. But then we had a few years where we did make a few years after that where we did make some reasonable money. It depends. You've got to be able to, if you grow a crop, you've got to be able to make money out of it.
That is Chris Robinson, a mango grower in Kununurra, speaking to Jess Baker. Chris does mangoes, but he also grows pawpaw, citrus, veggies. And I'll give you the little tip here. Chris produces the best red grapefruit juice on the planet. It's unbelievable. Now, speaking of drinks, this afternoon I've been waxing lyrical and speaking out loud about the prospects of wine grapes in Central Australia. We're joined this afternoon by Alex Nelson, who is a local historian based in the Alice. Give us the history lesson, Alex. When it comes to wine grapes in the centre, what has happened?
Oh, good day, Matt. Yeah, as someone has mentioned to you earlier, we had Chateau Hornsby Winery established here around about, well, certainly in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. So that was southeast of Alice Springs, out towards the airport and then across in the direction of Amungana Settlement. And that was something of an institution here for the latter part of last century. It was a very popular tourist site, and people used to take a camel to dinner by riding camel trains out along the bed of the Todd River and then across to the to the winery.
And it was a good drop, was it?
Depends on who you talk to. Some people. One of the big events each year was harvesting and crushing of the grapes on New Year's Day to keep the boast going that it was the earliest wine grape harvest in the country. And so that was a significant tourist attraction here in Alice Springs until about the turn of the century. I think it closed about year 2000 and no longer exists.
Now, we've only got a few seconds left in the country, Al, but that little vineyard at the community radio station, is it still there?
It's radio station 8HA opposite the Arid Zone Research Institute, and it was established and growing, but it changed hands and was abandoned, and so it's never gone into production to my knowledge, so it's just sitting there abandoned and languishing.
Okay. All right. Always appreciate your history and your knowledge, Alex. Have a lovely afternoon.
Thanks, Matt. You too.
That's Alex Nelson. Cheers, ladies and gentlemen. Keep it rural.